Welcome to you. My name's Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform. And on behalf of Senator Rockefeller, Senator Collins, our board of directors, very pleased to have you here at this program to examine the part of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, which we can agree for the next hour and 45 minutes we will call the ACA. We're going to look at a part of that act that has received relatively little attention, I think, and that is the changes in federal policies toward long-term care. And a lot of people think that long-term care, even today, means nursing homes, and indeed it does, but much of this new law's impact, in this area anyway, deals with services and supports that are community-based or delivered in the home as opposed to in institutions. So there are two major parts of our discussion today, if you will. First, we'll take a look at the so-called CLASS Act, which is the voluntary, nationally run insurance program designed to pay cash benefits for non-medical services and supports for people with functional limitations. Secondly, we're going to examine a number of ACA provisions that expand or improve services and supports that are available to that same population for with low incomes through Medicaid. I guess with a lot, as is the case with a lot of the programs that we've conducted in the last 6 months, particularly with our colleagues at the Kaiser Family Foundation, this session today is designed not so much to discuss the merits of a particular program that's in the new law, but rather to give us a clearer picture of exactly what's in there and provide the basis for further discussion and a little enlightenment, we hope. I'm very happy to be able to address this topic as an alum of the long-departed House Select Committee on Aging in the House of Representatives. We spent a lot of time talking about long-term care. And then as part of the staff of the Pepper Commission, which had an excellent consultant on long-term care issues, I think her name was Diane Rowland, we came up with a fabulous plan that got great support and went nowhere in Congress. So we're going to have another run at it here to take a look at what has already been done. And as is clear from my allusions, our partner today in today's program is the Kaiser Family Foundation, one of the best sources of information, I might add, about Medicaid and long-term care, some concrete examples of which are in your packets. And representing the foundation today is its Executive Vice President, Diane Rowland, the aforementioned, who also happens to chair MACPAC. You may not be familiar with that acronym yet, but you will be. It is the Medicaid and CHIP Payment and Access Commission. Did I get that right?
Right.
Okay. That was created as part of the ACA. Diane, thanks for being here, and very happy to have you push us toward this program.
Thank you. Thank you, Ed, for your opening remarks. I think we can clearly say that this forum and discussion today has been a long time in coming, as Ed noted. Health reform finally has been debated and enacted, so today we're here to talk about what it means, and it's especially nice to be able to talk about provisions that go beyond the healthcare coverage and exchanges that everyone has been talking about to really look at some of the promise that the legislation offers for making home and community-based services both more available and more affordable, either through the CLASS Act or through the changes enacted in the Medicaid program. I think it's particularly helpful to have forums like this where we try to understand the key provisions of the legislation, to understand some of the challenges of implementation, and we have just a great team today to talk about these issues. And so I think we should move on and hear what they have to say and hopefully how they explain what's going on. Thank you.
Thanks, Diane. Very quickly, As I say, you will find a lot of good information in your packets, including the speaker's slides, including biographical information that will go well beyond the short introductions we can give them from here. There are microphones that you can use for the Q&A part of the program, both in front and in the rear. There are green question cards in your packets that you can use to write your question down and have it brought forward. I already have one green card with 10 questions on it. I'm not trying to set a new bar, but don't be bashful. The webcast and the podcast of this briefing will be available Monday on the Kaiser Family Foundation website, kff.org. And in a few days, you can look at a transcript on our website, allhealth.org. On both of those websites, you'll find electronic copies of not only the materials in your packets, but others that we did not run off to save a few trees, but which I think you will find very interesting and helpful as you look further for information about this topic. There's a blue evaluation form that we hope you'll take the time to fill out at some point. And if you're watching on C-SPAN, it's not on live, so you can go home and turn it on at 2 in the morning when they rebroadcast it. But if you are watching on C-SPAN and have access to a computer, you can get the speaker slides and the other materials and follow along as the presentations are made, if you'd like. So, as Diane said, we have an incredibly good panel. Let's get to them. And we're going to start with Richard Frank, who's deputy to the HHS Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation. His responsibilities include aging and disability and long-term care and mental health. Easy areas. I'm sure he has them all under control. He is on leave from his position as professor of health economics on the faculty of the Department of Healthcare Policy within Harvard Medical School. He served on the Citizens Working Group on Healthcare, which was created, as many of you know, by Congress on the initiative of Senators Wyden and Hatch a few years ago. And he's here today specifically to help us understand the so-called CLASS Act, which was enacted as part of the ACA. Richard, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Ed. As Ed said, the Affordable Care Act under Title VIII established a national voluntary insurance program for purchasing community living and or institutional services to support that's become known or is formally known as the Community Living Assistance Services and Supports Program, or CLASS Act, or CLASS Program.
Richard, excuse me just a second. I want to make sure. Can you hear in the back? You might want to move the microphone a little closer.
Is that better? Okay, good. I'm not going to start over. I'm going to talk about the CLASS Act here. The CLASS Act has potential to really fundamentally alter the way Americans protect themselves against the financial consequences of needing long-term services and supports. Research shows that there are significant segments of the population that that can't buy long-term care insurance, and even though some of them may represent only slightly elevated risks of disability. It's also clear that precautionary savings by all but the wealthiest Americans are unlikely to offer sufficient protection against the financial risks and financial costs associated with long-term services and supports. And the CLASS Act is grounded in the principles of consumer direction and promotion of independence, and again represents progress in an effort to give people the flexibility to determine their own services in promoting their independence. So I'm going to briefly review the basics of the CLASS program, and then I'm going to note some of the issues that we're addressing as we move towards implementation of the Act. And then I imagine other things will come out in questions. Ed told me that 11 of the 10 questions he has are about the CLASS Act. So let me start with the basics. Enrollment, as I mentioned, is entirely voluntary. you must be age 18 or above, and you must be employed and have earnings. Employers can choose to participate in the program and enroll workers, deduct premiums through an opt-out provision. And that means that it would be sort of passive enrollment and active disenrollment. And then there's an alternative enrollment program that must be specified and created by the Secretary of HHS for people whose employers choose not to participate in the class program or who are self-employed or otherwise not part of an employer that could participate. The benefits of the class program, as I mentioned, the class program is a cash benefit, and it is going to be specified in greater detail by the Secretary by October 2012, which is what it says in the statute. It's scaled to different levels of disabilities. The Secretary is able to specify up to six categories of disability in which to tier the value of the benefits. And on average, the benefit has to amount to about $50 per day, or no less than $50 per day on average, assuming a regular distribution of the disabled population. And then the aim is really to help beneficiaries to continue living in the community, but money can also be spent for either residential or institutional services if that's what individuals choose to do. Now, examples of the kinds of things you might purchase are home modifications. You're allowed to roll up money over time and then make larger purchases, such as home modifications. We expect that a large portion of the money will be spent on hiring paid helpers to deal with people's limitations on activities of daily living. Also specified in the benefits are advocacy services, advice and assistance counseling, and then there's a sort of societal benefit in the sense that class benefits are the first payer and therefore are expected to at least offset some Medicaid services. 95% of class payments must go to a nursing home if the individual is enrolled in a nursing home. A smaller portion is to be used to pay for community-based services for people who are in home and community-based services. Let me talk about eligibility now. Individuals must pay premiums for 5 years and be working and earning income for three of those 5 years in order to qualify for benefits. What work means is that they need to work at a level that qualifies them for a quarter of Social Security, which is today is about $1,120. And so three out of the 5 years, you have to be earning at least that much. The functional limitations that are required to qualify for benefits have to be specified by the Secretary, but they're either two or three activities of daily living or an equivalent set of cognitive impairments that require you to get assistance and support. The Secretary of HHS is required to set up a national system for eligibility determination. So that means setting up a set of processes that are uniform across the country, which will do the ADL assessments, will do the cognitive assessments, and the cognitive assessments need to cover intellectual disabilities, Alzheimer's and dementia, but also disabling conditions related to severe and persistent mental disorders. Premiums. The program is self-financing from premiums and earnings over a 75-year horizon. So the law requires that it be self-sustaining for 75 years. Premiums will depend on age at enrollment and the year in which somebody is enrolled, but are not allowed to include traditional underwriting that's used in private health insurance, private long-term care insurance. Premiums will not be increased for individuals unless the Secretary along with the advice of her actuaries, determine that it is required in order to preserve the solvency of the program. So the secretary has flexibility to alter the structure of prices. There is a internal subsidy to the program where people below the poverty line and students are only allowed to be charged $5 for their premium initially, and that premium is indexed to inflation, as is the value of the benefit. Finally, administrative costs are capped at 3%. Now, let me talk to you about a few of the challenges that we're starting to deal with in the process of implementation. First of all, the authors of the CLASS Act anticipated a central role for employers in making it easy for people to enroll. And that was the sort of genesis of the opt-out provision. Now, what making it easy means, and getting employers to participate, means not only make it easy for enrollees, but making it easy for employers. That is that the way premiums are going to be determined requires employers to get a lot of information about people, potentially, to set premiums and to do withholding that they don't normally collect. And so one of the things we need to figure out in implementing this program is how do we make it easy for employers to kind of at low cost and low hassle administer what is a more complicated premium and withholding structure than you might otherwise see in other parts of benefit designs. We also have to set up this uniform eligibility and determination process. And while we have very well-developed systems in the private sector for doing assessments of activities of daily living limitations, we're far less well situated to move into the cognitive impairment areas, particularly for the non-elders, that is for people with intellectual disabilities or people with severe and persistent mental illness. And so we need to set up systems where we can consistently and uniformly across the nation do this in a way that's scientifically sound. And so that is a significant issue. As I mentioned earlier, the CLASS Act is also grounded in the principles of consumer direction and consumer autonomy, and it sets out a variety of examples of the types of services that might be used to promote independence. At the same time, there's a strong admonition to do everything that we can to preserve program integrity. And so we need to sort of find a balance and a set of mechanisms that balance the demands of program integrity with the respect for the principle of self-determination and independence. As I mentioned, there are very specific conditions under which Medicaid offsets can be collected. There's ambiguity and actually some technical messiness, for want of a better word, in the way that language is drafted. And so the regulatory authority that we've been given requires us to clarify how the Medicaid provisions will actually work. And then there are a variety of other regulatory requirements in the bill that we will be pursuing and implementing over the coming months. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard. Next, we're pleased to welcome Suzanne Bostick, who's an expert on Medicaid home and community-based services, as well as on quality and managed care issues. She's at CMS, where she is the Deputy Director of the Disabled and Elderly Health Programs Group. She's helped operate managed care projects, serving people eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid. She spent 15 years in Maryland's state government, and today she's going to tell us about the Medicaid-related long-term care provisions in the new law. Susie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you, Ed. Can everyone hear me? Okay, great. I get to be the first person to move the slides, so I'm hoping, good. Okay, we've mastered that, so now we'll move on to long-term care provisions. I'm really glad to be here today, and like the title of the session says, I think there are some really exciting opportunities in the Affordable Care Act, and I think there is a lot there that states can use to improve home and community-based services for both elderly and disabled individuals who need these services. What I'm going to do in my time today is very briefly review the major provisions around home and community-based services and non-institutional long-term care. And then I'd like to share with you some initial observations that the CMS staff who are working to implement these provisions have garnered from our analysis of these provisions. And I think you'll hear some common themes, common across the provisions, but also to some of the hallmarks that Richard just described in the CLASS Act. So let me start first with Section 2302 of the Affordable Care Act. And each of these slides will really just give you a nugget about the provisions, but I hope enough that you can see the value and benefit that many of these provisions will bring to home and community-based services. Section 2302 is a very simple provision, but it's very powerful in its simplicity because it's all about making it possible for children with life-threatening illnesses to receive curative treatment at the same time that they receive palliative treatment and have both of those paid for by Medicaid. Prior to the enactment of this provision, when a child with a life-threatening illness was enrolled in hospice and could receive the palliative care, Medicaid no longer provided for the curative treatment or paid for it, which as we talked to kids and parents across the country, it was something they so desperately needed to be able not to give up the hope for a cure for the illness, but at the same time to enjoy the benefits of palliative treatment and palliative care. So this is a very, very important provision. The second one is one which I suspect is very near and dear to the hearts of many people in this audience, and this is Section 2401, which is the enactment of the Community First Choice option. Again, a very, very important piece of legislation which will now make it possible for states to cover. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Joan. Now make it possible for states to cover attendant care and as an optional state plan benefit. This will add to the arsenal of tools that state Medicaid programs have in terms of home and community-based services for people with disabilities. This provision also comes with a very important enhanced financial Medicaid payment for it of 6%. So we're certainly hoping and talking to states and stakeholders about the opportunities of using this provision, even given the very difficult situations that state budgets are facing right now. We're hoping that that 6% bump up in the FMAP will be a draw for states to come in and choose this as an optional benefit.
And Susie, the FMAP is the federal payment?
Yes.
As the share of Medicaid?
Yes, thank you, Ed. It is the federal share of the expenditure for that service. And generally, there's an established payment rate for states based on their per capita income. This gives them a 6% increase in what they would normally receive from the feds for providing those covered services. The next provision is Section 2402, and there are actually two very significant parts to this provision, 2402A and 2402B. 2402A, we think, is some very powerful language. Again, it's simple, but we think it gives federal agencies, not just Medicaid, but federal agencies and state programs that provide home and community-based services, an opportunity to establish some very important principles of home and community-based services. And what you'll see here that the law requires, it actually directs the Secretary of HHS to promulgate rules on home and community-based services to ensure that states have systems in place for HCBS related to allocation of resources, providers, maximum choice and control. We are working very closely with Health and Human Services Work Group that includes all of our federal partners to go through the provisions of 2402A to understand the power and the flexibility of those provisions, and to really develop consensus across the federal agencies as to what these regulations should look like when the Secretary promulgates them. The work group is focusing on identifying what we would consider some of the hallmarks of home and community-based services. An example of that is person-centered planning. And so what the HHS work group is doing is comparing definitions across federal agencies as to what constitutes person-centered planning, with the goal of reaching consensus across the federal agencies as to what person-centered planning means, what requirements should exist around it. And then our goal would ultimately be to speak with the same voice when it comes to hallmarks like person-centered planning. So again, I think there's an awful lot of power, an awful lot of promise in this very short provision of the Affordable Care Act. 2402B made some legislative improvements to 1915I, which was a provision, actually it was a new section of the Social Security Act that was originally passed under the Deficit Reduction Act. And it made possible for the first time for states to cover as an optional benefit home and community-based services as a state plan optional service. Why is that important? Prior to the passage of 1915I, states could provide home and community-based services through something called a Medicaid waiver. And a waiver allows the state to waive certain rules of the Medicaid program, but it requires an application to CMS that has to be approved and then has to be renewed every 3 to 5 years. As a state plan optional benefit, once CMS approves it, it becomes a permanent part of the state's Medicaid program. It doesn't require renewal. So there was a lot of interest in making home and community-based services available as a state plan option. It was also very important because for the first time, it delinked the relationship between the institutional level of care and receiving home and community-based services. And what do I mean by that? In a waiver program, you have to be otherwise eligible for institutional care in order to get home and community-based services. With 1915I, that requirement went away. The receipt of home and community-based services is now based in 1915I on functional need. Much like, as Richard mentioned, the functional assessments for class, in 1915I, states now determine eligibility not on whether or not you've got 1 foot in a nursing home, but on whether or not your ADL requirements necessitate home and community-based services. So it's a very important benefit. What the Affordable Care Act did was make some changes to this benefit. In particular, it added the capability to serve a broader array of services, and it also made it possible for states to have more than one 1915I program, which had been an obstacle for some states. The next provision I'm going to focus on quickly is Section 2403, which was an extension of the Money Follows the Person program, which was originally authorized by the Deficit Reduction Act. And this is the very significant program that CMS has been operating for several years now, which allows states to submit an application, a grant application, to CMS for funds which will allow them to identify and move individuals who are in nursing homes or intermediate care facilities into home and community-based settings. A very important program, and what the Affordable Care Act did was extend that program to 2016. So we have more years to transition individuals and also to evaluate the demonstration which Money Follows the Person is. Section 20, I did it again. Whoops, I went too far. 2701, this is an interesting provision. It's not specific to home and community-based services. It requires the Secretary and CMS to develop a set of adult quality measures and then to develop a Medicaid quality improvement program. This may sound familiar to the requirements for quality measures under the CHIPRA, the Children's Health Insurance Program. It, we think, is very similar, and we're working very closely with our partners in CMS to create essentially an entire pool, if you will, of measures for both children and adults. including quality measures for the Home and Community-Based Services Program. I'm quickly running out of time here. Section 2703, we think, is a very important provision for system reform. This provision allows states to submit a state plan amendment to operate something called a Medicaid health home. And very quickly, this is an integrated model for individuals with multiple chronic illnesses that's designed to integrate both primary acute care and long-term care services and supports, and very importantly, behavioral health. States will be able to submit a state plan amendment to us for approval for a health home, and there is an enhanced match of 90% for the health home services that were specified in the statute. And then finally, Section 10202, which is called the Balancing Incentives Program. And this is a new authority that allows CMS to offer to states an opportunity to more greatly rebalance their systems, i.e. to move their spending and their service dollars over to non-institutional services away from institutional services. So to level out those expenditures compared to institutional and non-institutional services. There are some structural requirements, some things that states must do before they can qualify for these incentive payments, and we're working very closely with states and state associations to make sure that states can take advantage of this opportunity. And then I will end up very quickly. I did want to show you this very simple diagram, which points out what we think are some of the hallmarks of the Affordable Care Act and the hallmarks of home and community-based services in general. Person-centered thinking and planning, maximizing individual control for individuals who receive home and community-based services, integrating services, whether that's integrating payer sources, integrating primary, acute, long-term services and supports, behavioral health, and then finally, and of course, quality. The remainder of the slides, and I'll be very quickly here because I don't want to take away from other presenters' time, but as we looked at these provisions of affordable care, we saw some similar messages in these provisions, and we think that's a very important message and something that we will be conveying to states as we implement these provisions. And each of these slides represents one of those common themes. Person-centered planning, we saw it reflected in many of the provisions in the Affordable Act. Individual control, quality, and integration, and again, both of payer sources, but also integrating the services in the community in accord with the Americans with Disabilities Act. And then again, there are a number of provisions that offer enhanced FMAP. And then finally, I leave you with something that you may be familiar with now. As Dr. Berwick has joined CMS as the administrator, he has embedded in the organization his triple aim philosophy, which is about supporting population health, measuring the experience of care and improving the experience of care, and focusing on savings and per capita cost. Thank you. Oops.
Thanks very much. Tom Akins is up next. He's the CEO of the North Carolina Association of Nonprofit Homes for the Aging, which is an affiliate of the American Association of Homes and Services for the Aging. Tom's members offer a range of services from skilled nursing facilities to assisted living, affordable housing. So he and his members are already delivering services and supports to older people and those with functional impairments, and they're surely going to be involved in delivering the kinds of services and supports envisioned in the ACA. So we're very happy to have you with us today.
Thanks, Ed. Welcome to the non-technical portion of the program today. I'm happy to be here and offer a perspective of providers who are on the ground dealing with the legislation and the practical implications of that for their business model. It is informed by about 15 years worth of work in Kansas and North Carolina on the ground. and also owes a lot to the staff at the American Association of Homes and Services for the Aging. You all probably know Marcia Greenfield and Barbara Gay and Barbara Maynard. They're excellent at what they do, and they've been an integral part of this presentation. If you don't remember anything else today, this is what our providers tell me, boiled down. Chance favors the prepared mind. What our providers are looking for is information so that they can be prepared to take advantage of the chances that exist in this legislation. Very quickly, I know that we're all familiar with these demographics, but I want to give you some context for what it is that our providers face in their day-to-day operations, what they're seeing. Here's the globe in 2000. It just tells you where folks over the age of 60 lived. In 2000, globally, about 10% of the population was over the age of 60. If you fast forward to 2050, boy, we get older. 21% of the population globally now is over the age of 60. And if you look just at the United States, that top line, in 2000, about 16% of the population was over the age of 60. You fast forward to 2040, that's about 26% of the population that's over the age of 60. Now, why that's important for us is in two reasons. One is because of what we're paying in terms of public benefits to the elderly as a percent of our GDP. If you look back in 2000 in the United States, that was about 10% of our GDP was paid out as public benefits to the elderly. You fast forward to 2040, that becomes 20%. And if you look at something called the aged dependency ratio, basically how many people are paying into the system versus how many people are pulling out, in 2000 in the United States, that aged dependency ratio looked at about four people paying into the system for every one person pulling out. In 2040, that number dips to about two people paying into the system for every one person who's pulling money out of the system. What that says for our providers, for our folks on the ground, is that we cannot sustain the system the way that it's currently set up. We're either going to have to have people pay lots more in taxes, or we're going to have to cut benefits, or we're going to have to come up with a new model. And so, particularly over the last 3 or 4 years with the economic troubles that we've gone through, our providers not only know that they have to look at their business model, but they're enthusiastic in what they're looking for from you as information, because our providers have to expand their thinking beyond the bricks and mortar walls of their communities and look at how they can provide services that people need when they need them in the place that they call home. So I want to talk about four specific takeaways, but before I do, just to very quickly give you a short history of U.S. aging services. Very quick. During Civil War times, where did we take care of Grandma? We took care of her at home because there wasn't any money. There wasn't any public funds, and because we had lots of land. You move forward to the end of the century, and we had some money that became available for poor houses and almshouses, and that's where we housed the elderly who'd run out of money. In the early 1900s, we had money available for mental health care, and we built some insane asylums, and that's where we housed the elderly who had run out of money. We called them inmates. You fast forward to the 30s, we had money that was available for long-term care in hospitals. My Uncle Frank spent the last 4 years of his life in a long-term care unit at a county hospital. You come forward to the 60s when we had Medicare and Medicaid. There was money available for skilled nursing facilities, so we built a bunch of nursing homes. In the late 80s, we had the big assisted living boom, and we called them residents. So normally this would be the audience participation part of the program, but since you all have the PowerPoint presentation, you know where we're going with this, and that is today, where people want to be served, is back home. And so, here are the four takeaways that our providers are telling us that they're seeing on the ground, and they are these. First of all, the technology infrastructure provisions that are included in this legislation and that have been a part of the stimulus package, whether that's through health information exchanges or it's through electronic health records, means that we're going to have more data to make better decisions, and that with technology companies and venture capitalists investing more, it means that our ways of providing and supporting care are going to radically change. Secondly, the most important element of this legislation for our providers are the provisions around home and community-based services. Those provisions, including the CLASS Act that you heard Richard talk about, are going to marry with the demand that we see demographically, along with the customer's desire to be served in their home, and it's going to grow this segment of providing home and community-based services. And our providers want to know how they can structure their business model so that they can bring their expertise and their mission to that. Third, the new reimbursement models that are included in health reform legislation are something that are of incredible interest to our members, because having gone through what they've gone through the last 3 or 4 years, having taken a look at the demographics and understand we cannot sustain the system as we've done so in the past, they are hungry for information, usable information, whether that's about accountable care organizations or bundled payments, medical homes, quality-based incentives, and continued reductions to their payments. They want information, and I'll talk a little bit in a second about our challenge around providing that. Finally, if you take these first three takeaways, the technology infrastructure, home and community-based services, and the new reimbursement models, what it says to our providers is that we have to do a much better job of forming alliances and strategic partnerships if we're going to be successful. We can't do this by ourselves anymore or simply come back and continue to say, we just need more money. We are going to have to align with others, whether that's regional health systems or it's government or it's public policy organizations, whether it's foundations. We have to figure out how we can align with others so that we can marry those first three takeaways. I want to end by talking about what I see as public policy implications for this. And these three may seem somewhat simple. I am a simple person. My congressional background was not on the Hill. It was in a district office in Wichita, Kansas, working for Dan Glickman. And my biggest challenge in the district office was translating what happened here into usable information for folks back in my district. That's what I see with our providers right now. And I think from a policy perspective is one of our biggest challenges. The dissemination of information to folks outside of the policy community about how we can succeed with this and how we can replicate it. Secondly, you know, within the payment reform provisions of health reform, there are more than 40 pilot and demonstration projects. And those are a tremendous opportunity that our providers see as a tremendous opportunity. But we have to figure out how to quickly discern and then share that information from those pilot programs about what works and what doesn't work. We can do pilot programs and we can learn lots of things, but if we don't figure out how to disseminate this information, it's not going to be of value to very many people at all. Finally, the last policy implication, and for me, I think this is one of the most important. We have to figure out a way to take the opportunities within health reform and develop evidence-based data. This data, I think, can be utilized to demonstrate legitimate returns on investment and enable us, our providers, to proceed with appropriate policies that incentivize a rational business case for providing home and community-based services. And if we make that business case, it's going to make it possible for providers and hospitals and third-party payers to understand the business imperative that lies behind investing in reimbursement policies that support home and community-based services. I'm looking forward to the question and answer period and talking more about this. Ed?
Great. Thanks very much, Tom. Our final speaker is Joanne Lamphere, who is the director of state government relations at AARP. Folks in D.C. may not understand that AARP has a very strong network of state and local offices, and they work very closely with the legislatures and governors on issues of concern to AARP members, like, for example, long-term services and supports. And that means that Joanne and her colleagues are going to be focusing in the near future on these ACA provisions that we're looking at here today, as states consider how best to take advantage of them, implement them or not, as the case may be. So we're very anxious to hear what you have to say about these provisions that we're trying to come to grips with today. Joanne?
Thank you, Ed. This is the second portion of the non-technical part of this presentation today. For reasons unknown, and what Ed had mentioned earlier, is that one absolute jewel of the Affordable Care Act that's receiving so very little attention are these provisions that we're talking about today that would expand home and community-based health and social services for the frail, elderly, and disabled. Thankfully, the Alliance for Health Reform and the Kaiser Family Foundation have organized this briefing to remind us of these new opportunities and what is so much at stake. Our previous speakers reinforced the urgency of what's happening in America across the world, needing to get ahead of the aging trends. And our federal agency leaders were speaking about how they are making this dream of living independently at home a reality for millions across the United States. And we are grateful for their 24/7 work around the clock, putting out regulations and making policy decisions and working with states to make this dream a reality. This is an unprecedented investment, and it is a historic moment. And for those of you who have been working the Pepper Commission and even earlier to try to make these policy decisions, they finally happened in Washington. Our job is not over. It has just begun. We need to make this happen. We may need to make the reality state by state over the next few years. And for those of you who have been dedicated to making the Affordable Care Act a real piece of legislation, you'd be happy to know that as public understanding grows about this act, specifically its investment in community-based long-term care services and supports and improved chronic care models, their support for the law expands. And I'd like to just reemphasize that people, once they understand what is in this law, they really begin to like it. Now, why does America need improved home care and community supports for those with chronic conditions and who are disabled? First of all, as our previous speaker mentioned, there's not enough money in America to build institutional beds for our parents and our grandparents who are too sick to take care for themselves, that they need help bathing, they need supervision with their medicines, they're confused, they need help, but they want to live independently. There's not enough money to repair the bad care that people have been getting when they get old and are at the last points of their life. Our older family members want to be independent. They want to live at home as long as possible. Study after study, poll after poll, year after year, reinforces the understanding that 9 out of 10 Americans aged 50 and over say they want to live in their homes and their communities for as long as possible. Older folks fear becoming a burden on their families. Many of you know through personal experience what exactly those burdens may be. It may surprise some of you that it is the family caregivers who shoulder the overwhelming burden and responsibility of providing care for our beloved family members, our parents, our grandparents, our siblings, our spouses, and so forth. And AARP's Public Policy Institute estimated in 2008 that over $375 billion worth of free caregiving was provided. And so these provisions really help to support family caregiving at home and keep people in their homes. It may surprise you that Medicaid spending is still heavily weighted to institutions. It's been estimated over 55% of Medicaid long-term care spending still goes to institutions. And sometimes in some of the states, it can be as high as 60, 70, and 80%. So I'd like to emphasize again the value of home and community-based services, the Medicaid program, and why it's so very important to driving system change. Medicaid provides the architecture and the framework and the funding to drive system improvements across the United States. As I mentioned, Medicaid funding is still largely allocated to institutions. Yet, we know, again, from study after study, that well-crafted, well-designed home and community-based programs are cost-effective. Indeed, they can support nearly 3 adults and individuals with disabilities, on average, for every 1 person who is at home. And states that invest in home and community-based services can, over time, slow their rate of growth of Medicaid spending on long-term care. And while expansion of home and community-based services does involve an initial state investment, a reduction in the institutional spending and long-term care cost savings do result. These are exciting times. Across the United States, public and private sector leaders in healthcare are designing and testing expanded and integrated new models of care, and the new federal law supports these developments. You've heard how the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, provides important opportunities to improve the structure and setting of care between institutions and home and community-based services. The balancing incentive programs, community first choice, money follows the person, and many others. And in addition, this law uses Medicaid to transform healthcare delivery. Healthcare, medical care homes, improves workforce, improves quality, improves care transitions. And I'm certain that there'll be other alliance briefings to explore these many very important topics. But they are a companion to what we're talking about with long-term care. States still are struggling with revenue shortfalls from this Great Recession and have depended on federal stimulus funds through enhanced federal Medicaid matches to continue their Medicaid and their non-Medicaid home and community-based services. We expect that this challenging, indeed dire, fiscal situation in many states to continue for many years. And so this federal investment in home and community-based services is quite welcome. Leaders in many states are using the recession and this new law to better balance the long-term care sector, to expand home and community-based systems, and to drive system changes. Our hope is that the law will be implemented in such a way to maximize state participation through incentives and flexibility. If the goal is indeed balancing, look to where the balance has not yet been achieved. Achieving the promise of health reform. One challenge that we face in expanding home and community-based services is that, and this might surprise you, Medicaid, home and community-based services is still considered an optional service under state plan. So when states are finding it very difficult to balance their budgets, they look to where they can cut. And we have learned that home and community-based services continue to be vulnerable in these tough economic times. So I would urge you to put on your creative hats, reach out to your state colleagues in the public and private sectors, and forge alliances and forge a planning process so that the states will indeed avail themselves of this unprecedented opportunity to expand and improve home and community-based services across the United States. Now is the time for bold innovation, for creativity, to design new ways of doing things. We can do it. The time is right now. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks very much, Joanne. And now it's time for you to get into the conversation. As I say, you have green cards that you can write questions on, hold them up, and someone will bring them forward. And there are, as some have already discovered, microphones to which you can repair to ask directly your questions. I would ask that you be as brief as you can in stating your question, direct it to somebody specific if that's your want, and make sure that you identify yourself. And we'll start with the person who was first at the microphone in the back and work our way forward. Go right ahead.
Thank you. I'm John Green with the National Association of Health Underwriters. Mr. Secretary, you mentioned that you anticipate a lot of adverse selection with respect to the CLASS Act in terms of folks that will likely sign up because they can't pass underwriting in the long-term care insurance market, and that there are a large cohort who are going to pay $5. Wondering how you sustain this program on a voluntary basis and not make it mandatory.
I didn't catch the last part of your question, which was?
I'm not sure how you sustain this program as a viable pay-as-you-go, self-sufficient program with a $5 payment and the adverse selection and keep it a voluntary program.
Well, the interesting thing is the authorities given the secretary. There are, in a sense, authorities both that guide enrollment and the sort of conduct of the program, but there are also authorities that require our secretary to do what it takes to keep the program solvent. What we're doing right now is focusing a great deal on trying to design a program that will increase the take-up rates above what have frequently appeared in estimates reported in the media. And so it's really using the flexibility and the authorities given the secretary to really try to get a program that will be situated in the market in such a way that we can really get the maximum amount of participation, because participation is a very important answer to sort of your issue here.
Richard, can I just ask as a follow-up, have you had any enough time to gauge the reaction of the employer community to seizing the role that the law states for them giving their workers a chance to opt out but putting them on otherwise? Because presumably that would have a big impact on the participation rate.
The answer to that is the short answer is that we don't fully understand. We haven't done a complete survey of the employer community. We've been out talking to a lot of employers. We've been actually spending a lot of time worrying about how to make it easy for employers, because to some extent the conversations we've had say, you know, if you can make it easy, if we don't increase our burden, we'll entertain the idea of doing this. And so we've been working with, for example, the payroll management industry to try to figure out ways that we can sort of design both information systems, but also processes and procedures that will be run in part by the government to really simplify the role of the employer in this.
Paul Wilging, Johns Hopkins University. This is not a coordinated program with the previous questioner, but it does have to do with the actuarial soundness of the CLASS Act. And indeed, in one of the very good handouts in the packet, the American Academy of Actuaries suggested it is not actuarially sound. I believe that CMS's own actuaries raised some questions about the soundness of this program. But assuming, given your response, Dr. Frank, that the Secretary has the ability to adjust the program based on its success or failures, does that not create potentially a death spiral? So the secretary increases premiums, you have even fewer sound people signing up for the program, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we eventually end up with a program that is going to require mandatory participation to get the kind of involvement that the program needs to be actuarially sound.
Well, I mean, in a sense, what you just said is the sort of the other side of what adverse selection is all about, is that, in fact, if you start to disproportionately attract bad risks, your premium goes out and you lose your best investors. That is clearly a challenge here. And as I mentioned a moment ago, really one way to address the challenge is to try to broaden the base of participation as far as possible. And so obviously that means trying to find the price points in the market that will allow you to bring people in. It means trying to locate the benefit design in ways that it appeals to people perhaps that haven't rushed into the existing private insurance markets. There's actually quite a bit of literature out there with evidence suggesting directions to go in trying to appeal to slightly different audiences. And then people come to these decisions with a tremendous amount of misperception and misunderstanding of the risks and the costs and the consequences of needing long-term services and supports. And so we're also working hard on trying to come up with ways of educating the public about why this might be a reasonable set of products to pursue.
Stuart Gordon with AmeriGroup. Tom, this question's for you. Your members who are nursing home members have over decades made a huge capital investments in brick and mortar. And if this movement is successful and the situs of care is going to move away from those buildings, have your members given any thought to how they might convert the uses of the nursing homes to other uses, and are there, do you see resources or incentives and the Affordable Care Act that might help to facilitate that?
That's a great question, and I'm not sure that I do see provisions within the Act that encourage us to look at ways to use those facilities perhaps for something else. I think that our members who are strictly skilled nursing facility providers understand the imperative behind trying to figure out how to do more in the way of partnering with folks in the community. I think that there will always be, and I want to make sure that, and I know that that's something that we all feel on the panel, and that folks in this room feel, that there is a workforce out there in skilled nursing facilities who provide great care and compassionate care for folks who are there, and that our move towards looking at things for home and community-based services is not necessarily an indictment of the way in which we provided care in the past, because we're doing lots of good things about trying to figure out how to change that model. But I think what it does mean for our members and what they're trying to figure out is, who can we partner with, who can we look to align with in the future, so that we're just not out there as a standalone kind of entity.
Okay. We're going to take one question from the floor here with regard to Section 2402B and the 1915I provisions. Is there any flexibility in the income and asset requirements? What populations can be defined to be included in that? Mm-hmm.
The law is actually fairly specific about the requirements for eligibility for 1915I. But certainly in terms of functional requirements, it's up to the states to define the functional criteria that determines who serves. So I think there is flexibility around functional requirements.
Good afternoon. My name is Carol Regan. I'm with the Paraprofessional Healthcare Institute. And I have a quick comment and then a question for Richard and Suzanne. One of my comments is, and I appreciated the data you shared, Joanne, about the cost savings that can come from home and community-based services. But one of the worries we have is that if you build it, they're going to come. And we know that paraprofessionals, particularly personal care attendants, make much lower wages than folks in institutional care. are much more likely to lack health insurance, and there are no federal training standards. So we have to be, I think we need to be careful as we move into this new system to make sure that we build a strong, competent, and stable workforce. Moving into that, I wanted to ask both Suzanne and Richard, in the CLASS Act and in the payment reform policies, what sort of things you envision in terms of thinking about around looking at assessing the need for the new this workforce, as well as how payment policies could change the incentives a little bit to raise the floor for paid caregivers.
I'll go first then. I think there are some issues around assessing the workforce, certainly around CLASS. And as we increase the number of home and community-based services, obviously it's going to increase the demand for direct service workers. And I think one of the great challenges in home and community-based services is that as we expand that service base, we have to be very careful that we don't sacrifice the quality of those services. Because in my mind, one of the worst things we could do in home and community-based services is to transition an individual from an institution into a setting where we can't assure their health and welfare and we can't assure their quality. And certainly the workers and the training and the competency of those workers is key in home and community-based services, especially because frequently there isn't the kind of daily supervision that you might have in an institutional setting. So it's a critical issue. We have been using some of our demonstration money, working with work groups in the department as well to look at direct service worker initiatives, whether it's around training, whether it's increasing the capacity of the workforce. But that's been our primary vehicle to date, is using our demonstration money, working with the different associations that foster and support training and competency for healthcare workers. We'll continue to do that as well.
Richard?
Thanks, Carol, for that question. It's a complicated problem. It's, you know, I think it's a real hard problem. We have, as part of the CLASS Act, there's a Workforce Advisory Commission that's now been chartered, and its members are about to be named. And without getting ahead of those announcements, we had over 200 applications from incredibly qualified people. So I think the thing that makes me optimistic is we're going to have really some of the nation's leaders and some of the best minds advising the secretary on this. In addition, HHS is doing a variety of things. We're working with the Department of Labor to use concepts around apprenticeship programs and things like that to really bolster those types of activities. And also there's an interaction between kind of states' commitments to sort of support the development of the direct care workforce in connection to the financial intermediaries that might be involved in the CLASS program. And I think that gives us a new set of institutional tools for addressing both the quality and also just the sort of risks and dangers that can happen on both sides of the market in those types of workplace interactions.
All right, thank you, Ed. My name is Lee Page, and I'm with PVA, Paralyzed Veterans of America. And thank you to Kaiser and the Alliance for having this briefing. It's been a long time overdue because, as you know, this, as Joanne said, this is a small part of the big bill, but it's an extremely important part. And as I believe, one of the most important because with all the baby boomers and people are going to be needing these type of services in the near future. But I guess my question or statement is, talking about the CLASS Act and listening to your opening remarks about how revolutionary this idea is and how it has the potential to really change the future of the way long-term services are provided at the home and community-based level, or what have you, and then looking at some of the information in the packet, the Academy of Actuaries and some others basically are talking about more of a negative way of the system not necessarily being sustainable. And I guess the question is, you know, business has been, you know, you need a comprehensive education and outreach campaign, which I assume that HHS will do as soon as the office is implemented, but also that, you know, business has been taking out funds for Social Security, Medicare, 401ks, and health saving accounts and all of the above. So I can't imagine another deductible line could be that hard to figure out and where the money would go to. So I'm just hoping that, you know, you as a person who's probably going to be very active in this program once it goes forward can look at some of these issues and you know, be open to other ideas. Thank you.
I appreciate the vote of confidence. One thing you said at the very beginning is pretty instructive. That could you imagine, you know, if we scroll back 3 years or 5 years, where we would say that there's a $10 billion a year program to finance long-term services and supports, and nobody would pay any attention to it? I mean, it's just, you know, in any other universe, this would be a big deal, and it's only in this universe that it perhaps isn't. I just want to comment on one other point you made, which is one of the things that I think is very important to think about here is that the very fact of the Class Act and its, you know, unique characteristics, and they cut in a variety of ways, is, I think, going to change the way the market works. And I think that having more diversity, a different pricing strategy, a different approach to selling, a different approach to putting out information, I think has the potential to change the market independent of the long-run viability of the program in a way that will generally benefit consumers. And I don't think people have paid very much attention to that. And I think there's a great potential here to actually change the way we do business so it's more transparent. I mean, I think so.
Thank you, Ed. I'm Valerie Wilbur with the National Health Policy Group, and my question is to all of the panelists, not one in particular. I wonder if you could comment on potential synergies between the Class Act and the other long-term care provisions mentioned, and specialty managed care programs like special needs plans, PACE, managed long-term care Medicaid programs and such. And is the second part of the question is there a specific role for the new Center for Medicare Medicaid Innovations and the new federal coordinated health care office in helping to implement these various long-term care provisions? Thank you.
Two good questions.
Well, I would just say from the perspective of our providers, if this is going to be successful, there has to be a way to link all of those different folks together, because what you'll find is that more and more our providers are involved not just in one particular thing. They've got PACE programs. They've got adult daycare. They've got skilled nursing. They've got independent living and assisted living. And other entities do as well. And I think if this is going to be successful, we'll have to figure out a way for those folks to do a better job of aligning with each other and being efficient with those resources.
I likewise think there are a lot of synergies, and I think even more will emerge as we get into the implementation of the different provisions in the Class Act. And I hope you've heard already, I mean, there are just some obvious parallels between the Class Act and the Affordable Act provisions around assessing for functional need, looking at the whole individual, providing a similar set of services, whether it's in a public program or in a voluntary program like the Class Act. And to answer your second question, we absolutely are working very closely with the Center for Strategic Planning and CMS and the new leadership around duals and the Federal Office for Coordinated Healthcare to focus on the duals population. It's interesting because as people talk about the coordination and integration of Medicare and Medicaid and having worked in home and community-based services for so many years, I look at the home and community-based waiver program where you have a very large percentage of duals. So the integration of payer sources and different settings of care is fundamental to our being able to provide services in a more efficient, more cost-effective, and a better way. There are a lot of discussions going on within CMS right now, even around things like quality provisions and trying to align the different requirements of quality in the Affordable Care Act provisions, where, whether it's on the Medicare side or the Medicaid side. We're trying very hard to align those expectations and those requirements for states and providers.
Hi. Again, thank you for putting this on. It's really, really good. And I'm Suzanne Mintz with the National Family Caregivers Association. Lee pointed out that, you know, long-term care is a small piece of the Affordable Care Act. Family caregivers are a much smaller piece than even that. And as Joanne noted, family caregivers are the backbone of care for persons with chronic illness and disability. So on the one hand, it's good that we are actually mentioned in the law, but in talking with various people within the administration and outside, it does not seem that any attention is going to be paid to these provisions within the implementation. And so I suggest to those of you who can do something about that, if we're so important to the system, then give us the respect of implementing those few pieces that are in there that will marginally assist family caregivers and their loved ones.
Can I react to that? Actually, I think I want to apologize if we haven't communicated well enough what we are trying to do. First of all, as you know, the CLASS Act, one of the things that we expect much of the money to go to is actually cushioning the impact, the financial impact on families, being allowed to hire relatives and pay them to be able to insulate them from the sort of job disruptions that come from caregiving. But in addition to that, we're doing two pieces of work that relate very closely to what we need to know to implement these provisions. One is we're implementing a supplement to the what's known as the NHAT survey, which is sort of like a long-term care survey that's focusing on family caregivers and informal caregivers. And that's actually going into the field this coming year so that we can really get a much stronger evidence base that we've had in the past on what's going on in that segment of the world. The other thing is, as part of the cost effectiveness funding under ARRA, ASPE has commissioned some research looking at the use of assistive technologies in order to prevent injuries. And as you know, most of those, a great deal of those injuries happen to informal and family caregivers. And it's really focused on how we can use those technologies, and that links directly into how people will start spending money in the CLASS Act to sort of support those family caregivers. So, you know, clearly your point is well taken, but we are trying to do some things that relate. No, this is ASPE along with NIA. Oh, these comparative effectiveness? No, this is being funded directly out of ASPE.
The surveys?
No, the survey is NIA, National Institute on Aging, and we're supplementing it.
One of the ways that AARP has been working with state policymakers on the issue of caregiving is to change the language that we use when we describe the benefits and services available through home and community-based services. You can imagine that state budget officials are very concerned about the cost of Medicaid, and the term people will come out of the woodwork. AARP doesn't think people are cockroaches. And of course people will come quickly and join in long lines for well-designed services that are available under federal and state law. So we try to help state officials understand that the onus is on them, on a larger planning process where people, providers, you know, budget people can come together and figure out a program that is affordable, that is high quality, and that supports the care that is already going on and that will continue to take place even though there are these new home and community-based services.
I'm Lori Simon Rosinowitz at the University of Maryland School of Public Health and also the research director for the National Resource Center for Participant-Directed Services, which is a mouthful, and what it really means is that it's the third phase of the cash and counseling program, which would not have happened certainly without major support from ASPE and CMS and other funders. My question goes back to the conversation about training and how to meld the very real concerns about high quality workers with a consumer-directed philosophy. And in recent years, there's been a shift in that conversation more toward the requirements versus thinking about consumer-directed principles. And I'd love to hear more about how that might happen.
Lori, one thing that I failed to mention in the slides is that I think every single provision of the Affordable Care Act that I described today either explicitly talks about self-direction and person-centered planning, or if it wasn't explicit, there's room for it to be there in the regulation. So we are focused very strongly on making sure that states have the flexibility to do self-direction, person-centered planning. Also in 2402A, when I was talking about the hallmarks and the Secretary's ability to promulgate regulations across HCBS writ large, certainly one of those principles that we can't imagine not being in that group is self-direction. So I think if you aren't hearing it already, at least on the Medicaid side, you will hear it and continue to hear it across the implementation of all of these provisions.
Suzanne, we do have a complimentary question from a state agency about what requirements there are for the attendant care benefit. Is there any limit on the size of the benefit per hour, per day, self-direct, who can be a provider attendant? Are these things going to be left up to the state, or how much is going to be specified by the federal government?
As we're looking at developing the regulations for Community First Choice, there is not a strict definition in the statute. It does talk about the types of activities that would be included as a part of attendant care services. So we would likely give a great deal of flexibility to the states. There's not a limit on the types of providers, as happens in most Medicaid state plan services. We would ask the states to determine the provider qualifications and describe to us what those qualifications would be. So there are no hard and fast limits. I think one of the issues that we're trying to balance and address very carefully with the Community First Choice Act is the breadth and scope of attendant services. I think those words mean different things to different people. And some of the discussions that we've had so far with our stakeholders is attendant care just enhanced personal care? Or is it something more unique than an enhanced personal care service? So that's one of the questions we're trying to get a lot of input on so that as we develop the regulation, we find that right balance around attendant care services, because there is an enhanced match here. And so one would argue that the enhanced match is looking for something beyond personal care that's already can be covered in the state plan. So we're trying to find that right balance around attendant care services.
And you should know that there's also a question about when you're going to release the details on the Community First Choice.
Not a surprising question. We have a laundry list, as you can imagine, of state Medicaid director letters and regulations that we're developing. Right now, we are actually drafting the regulation, the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking for Community First Choice. And it's always hard to anticipate when that rule is going to be released, because obviously we want lots of people to take a look at it and make sure we've got it right. But generally, it's about a 5 to 6 month window for clearance for a Notice of Proposed Rulemaking.
Yes, hi, I'm Sue Flanagan from the Westchester Consulting Group, and I had a comment about the self-directed direct service workforce. IRS, over the past years, have made it very clear that, in general, home-based care workers are employees of someone and not independent contractors. And over the last 20 years, states have worked very hard to implement what we call financial management services to make sure that workers get to pay in to receive Social Security and Medicare, but also that there's program integrity there. I guess my question or comment would be, under the CLASS Act, how will people go about developing the mechanism to make sure that this occurs on the CLASS Act side?
This actually goes back to the synergy question earlier. It's actually no accident that the work group on CLASS and the work group on some of the Medicaid provisions are together. It's one work group, and so Suzanne's office and my office sort of are very involved together. And so really we're taking, as we sort of put together our policy ideas for how to address those issues, we're starting with cash and counseling. And we're starting with the FMSs. And the issues are slightly different in that we have to go to a national system. And so what was that? Okay.
We haven't heard anything about the work in local communities on aging in place for the elderly. And in the homes in which they live and in the community, I'm involved in the Montgomery County Older Women's League, which is an advocate for quality of care and plans for the elderly. And aging in place has become an important issue among advocates of quality of care for those living in Montgomery County who are older. And the Commission on Aging, which consists of professionals, and they're all volunteers, and they have been approved by the council, they have come out with very strong philosophy and programs to state to the council what has to be done and what the council's programs have been that really hurt aging in place, like the automatic pension.
I'll just take that. I mean, I agree. We agree. And one of the innovative things that's going on right now is our secretary and Secretary Donovan have put together a collaboration, HUD and HHS, to address a variety of issues, including homelessness. But one of the really exciting things we're working on right now is housing with services for elders. And literally, probably today, there was an award made to help us think about how to design a demonstration program to put that together. It's jointly being funded by HHS and HUD. And really, what this is going to do is it's going to Montgomery County, it's going to Chicago, it's going to a variety of other places with model programs to really think about what is scalable, what is implementable, and how do you marry it with what we've learned about coordinated care. So you're right there, and we're probably trailing you a little bit, but we're interested.
This is a question related to the timing of state actions, recognizing the fiscal condition of states today. What kinds of things can you envision them doing sooner rather than later? What guidance are they waiting for to be able to move forward? Directed to Joanne and to Susan.
In terms of the Affordable Care Act provisions, we have already released a number of our usual state Medicaid director letters to give states initial guidance before the proposed rules and the final rules come out. So we really are very sensitive to the fact that, especially given state budgets, that states need to know sooner rather than later what types of infrastructure changes they need to make, in order to take up some of these benefits. So we are trying to get the guidance out as soon as possible. We could receive applications from states any time now for some of the Affordable Care Act provisions, especially the ones that become effective. Health Home becomes effective January 1 of 2011, so literally a state could submit an application at any point in time to us for the Health Home. So we are trying to get that information out through state SMD letters and also through something we've just initiated, informational bulletins that we distribute to a very large audience, which is not a policy communication, but it's general information that should be helpful to individuals participating in the Medicaid program.
The clock has already started. There are some states that have long histories of working on aging, disability, home care, community care projects and issues, and they are looking to others, they're looking to providers, you know, the federal agencies, stakeholders, to provide information so that they can move forward. And many states are very energetic and excited about these provisions for the reasons we were talking about today. Some states seem to lag. They're either very concerned about the budget or they don't have the constituency. They haven't had the experience yet of moving the dial towards more and better quality home care. And that's going to take time, and that's why I was encouraging you all to work with your state counterparts to build that level of education and set up a process by which you can start sharing information and working on some of these solutions. And I'd encourage you to work. Sometimes consumers can get stuck in their own little world and providers in their own little world. And given competing priorities for state agency attention, given the fiscal problems, given that many of their experienced leaders have retired, if we can come together at a stakeholder level and help solve some of those problems for the state official, then we're not bringing problems and demands to them. We're kind of giving them a gift that takes a little bit more creativity. We have to get out of our little boxes, but it's doable, and it is going on in several different states.
Mike.
Oh, hi. I'm Carl Pulzer. I'm with the American Healthcare Association National Center for Assisted Living. And this is just a reflection more on the synergy category. One of the big impacts of the bill is on coverage expansion. That I think the fact that we're going to have so many million more people insured is really going to impact the long-term care workforce. Where this is a place where we have a lot of uninsured folks now, a lot of low-wage workers and small firms. And that's a good thing. They're going to have a more opportunity to have health insurance. The flip side of that is that the cost structure of providing the care is going to go up dramatically, possibly, with the cost of insurance compared to the wages that these folks make is quite large. And this is in an environment where we have state budgets under in crisis and the federal government thinking of all kinds of ways of economizing. So has there been any thought given to how are we going to pay for these expansions into home and community-based services and this ongoing effort while we enhance the benefits for these low-wage folks in long-term care?
You seem to have stumped the band.
Well, I certainly many of the very lowest wage workers will be getting their coverage under health reform through the Medicaid program, so that the cost will be there for their health insurance coverage, mm-hmm. which should help enhance their ability to take care of the individuals. So you'll have Medicaid beneficiaries helping other Medicaid beneficiaries.
And I wonder if any of the panel, or for that matter, we have a lot of very well-qualified folks in the audience as well. This raises a question that actually got flagged very early in our conversation about the impact of the movement toward home and community-based services on overall cost trends. And I should know the answer to this question, but I don't, and I wonder if anyone does, about what kind of estimates CBO made, if any, about that kind of impact. I mean, does this movement actually save you money, bend the cost trend in the future at some point? Joanne cited some research that seemed to indicate that that was the case in general, but how about this specific piece of legislation? Richard?
Yeah, as you know, that the class act is responsible in the CBO estimates for about $70 billion in budget savings over 10 years. So there's that piece of it. There's also Medicaid offsets that are contained in there from those provisions that I mentioned at the beginning of my remarks. In terms of, thinking about what I think is implicit in your question, which is, on average, is home and community-based care overall a net cost saver? I don't think that we know quite enough yet about sort of the net-net effect, just because you're changing the number of recipients and you're moving people into just a whole range of different services. So I actually don't think we quite know the final answer to that question.
You have an answer, Mary?
Mary Jane Corn from the Commonwealth Fund. We're engaged right now in a partnership with AARP and the SCAN Foundation to develop a long-term care state scorecard, trying to look at quality measures so that we can compare the quality of long-term care services within states. And it has really staggered us on how difficult that is. We are really limited very often only to nursing home measures and sometimes home care measures. So my question is, as we have sort of stimulated services in states using federal and other monies, are we also going to be developing ways to develop and collect measures so that we can, in fact, compare quality across states to see how states are doing, not only just for interest, but also to help them understand where their gaps and where their needs are to strengthen things?
I would certainly say that CMS is interested in moving in that direction. And if you remember the slide about the adult quality measures, I think we feel that the Affordable Care Act has given us a renewed impetus to try to gather from the states more consistent standardized measures of quality so that we can do that comparison, because we do know that states are in very different positions when it comes to the development of their quality infrastructure. Many states do an exceptional job. Other states have some additional work to do, and certainly our approach on the home and community-based waiver side has been to allow states to develop their own measures. We've been working with them for many years now, and actually we've seen a lot of improvement in states in terms of developing that quality infrastructure, being able to collect data and measures that tell them something about the quality of their services they're providing. We'd like to have access to that information as well, so that we can draw some conclusions about quality comparatively across the country. So it's certainly something we're working towards.
Diane has a couple of questions on cards. Let me just say, as we get toward the end of our time, I'd very much appreciate it if you would pull out those blue evaluation forms, share your opinion about how we can make these programs better as we go along. Diane?
This is an informational question about whether Class Act dollars can be used in nursing homes and assisted living facilities. Some say yes, others say no. What's the answer, Richard?
Well, the statute says, you can use them for any of those types of services. Certainly, it's very clear on nursing homes, but basically there are assisted living examples in the legislation as sort of the types of services that you would be able to spend money on.
Then another question is, at a recent national home and community-based service waiver conference this week, apparently a suggestion was made that home and community-based services be the default service and require a waiver for institutional care under Medicaid. The audience there strongly supported this idea. What do these panelists think of that option?
Tom?
Well, it looks like it's about 2 o'clock now. So. a novel concept that I'm sure Richard would love to implement and develop the regulations for. I think what it points up is that there are different models that face us as providers, and that we've got a lot of work to do in terms of trying to figure out how we provide people with different options, whether that's aging in place for folks in Montgomery County who want to do that, whether it's folks who want to take advantage of other kinds of services. There are lots of models out there, and we've got to figure out how we perhaps don't hamstring folks into a one-size-fits-all, but give some folks some options for things to look at.
And a last question, how will the CLASS Act affect long-term care insurance industry and the long-term care industry in general?
We can have both.
The short answer is it's really hard to tell at this point. But as I said a little earlier, I do think that having a major new entrant into the market that does things differently, particularly when it has to face the federal government, has the potential to change some of the competitive dynamics in the industry.
Yeah, I think that the education process that's going to occur as we try and tell people about the CLASS Act and its provisions will have spillover benefits to other folks as well. You know, I see one of the biggest challenges to an actuarially sound system as my daughter. My oldest daughter is 19 years old, and she is invincible. She's at Bethel College right now, doesn't let classes stand in the way of her education, and she's going to live forever. And it's trying to convince Elizabeth and her peers that this is something that they need to understand and invest in is a big challenge for this system. But I think as we do that, there will be opportunities for everybody to be at the table with products and services that they have.
And a final question for both Richard and Suzanne. Everyone wants to know what the best way to follow what you're doing and what the details are of the CLASS Act and of the Medicaid changes. So can you give your advertisement about how to follow your work?
No.
Is there a website or a source?
Well, there is always a CMS website. But we are really trying very, very hard to get this information out as quickly and to all the people who need to see it. I'm not sure we have all the best strategies yet for that, and we're certainly trying to work on it every day. But I would say don't hesitate to call any of us. Look at the website. Subscribe to the SMD letters. You can do that on our website so that you can receive the SMD letters when they're posted. Watch the Federal Register, all those usual sources of information.
On a CLASS Act front, we are working very hard to stand up a CLASS office and searching for an administrator for the program. And again, I mentioned that we've chartered the advisory council, and so in the coming weeks or 1 or 2 months anyway, there'll be probably the secretary will be announcing the location of the office, the name of the administrator, the members of the first advisory panel, followed then probably beginning of next year by the Independence Advisory Council, which is sort of like the Board of Trustees.
Well, this has been an incredibly rich discussion. I've learned a lot, and I've also learned that there's a lot more that we didn't talk about that I have to learn. I want to thank you for stimulating a lot of that discussion and learning. I want to reiterate our thanks to the Kaiser Family Foundation and Diane for putting this program forward and certainly playing a big part in shaping it. And as a result, we had such a wonderful panel that I'd like to ask you to help me thank them for a great discussion. And thank you for those evaluation forms you're about to give us.
You seem to have a lot of questions.
Yes. Well, I'll spend the next week.
Welcome to